it seems, to have a dream, to open and run a bakery. But they took a chance, took the sweets to the street. Now they all have places where I'd love to eat.
Hello there, bakeroos and bakerettes. Welcome to a special Second Rise episode of the Rise Up podcast. This is the show about bakers and bakeries and bakery owners and all the folks that work so hard, often through the night, to make the good stuff for the people in their communities. I hope you're doing well this week. Cindy and I are off traveling. We are heading to the UK, to Scotland and England to see our kids and visit some friends and maybe see some bakeries. But I don't want to leave you alone at the bench while we're away. So the Second Rise episodes are past episodes from our ample archives of over 170 episodes at riseuppod.com. I'm going to be sharing some of my favorites with you over the summer, and we'll be back with new episodes starting on August 24th. Today on the show, I'm talking with Randy George. Randy's one of my mentors from back when we had Orange Boot Bakery. Another one of these people that I never spoke to one-to-one until we had this talk back in September of 2018. Everything we had talked about before was always via emails, either one-on-one or mainly through the chat group at the Bread Bakers Guild. But when I was planning out this podcast and sort of dreaming of starting it, Randy was one of the people at the top of my list of people to talk to, because he was always really focused on putting his employees front and center at the bakery. He was the guy that you turned to when attracting employees and retaining employees came up. Also, because his bakery is a wholesale operation, and I didn't know anything at the time about running wholesale, I wanted to talk to him because I was really curious about learning about the wholesale side of things. So I was thrilled when we finally got to spend some time together. There's lots in this talk that you're going to love. So let's get going right away here with Randy George of Red Hen Baking Company in Middlesex, Vermont. So thanks so much for being part of this again, like I said. But I guess my first question, Randy, is I'm curious, because I've never been to Vermont, but it seems to me that it's both a very small state, but has an awful lot of really great bakeries. Like, yeah. What's going on in Vermont? What's the magic?
What's going on? Well, I guess maybe it has to do with a larger food culture. I mean, we could probably talk for an hour about what's going on and why is Vermont the way it is. But if I can put it into a nutshell, I might say, and try not to go back hundreds of years, and I'm not a historian, but, you know, I've heard historians talk about why our culture is the way it is here. I think that it has to do with a combination of an agricultural heritage rather than an industrial heritage, which our neighbor to the east, New Hampshire, has more.
Oh, okay.
You know, I mean, and that has to do with the landscape itself. You know, the northern part of New Hampshire is that's where Mount Washington is. It's so rugged,
right,
that you can't really farm or have much in the way of industry there. And then to the south, it's New Hampshire is closer to Boston and has a long history of mills and things like that. Mm-hmm. Whereas Vermont has more of a kind of rolling hills landscape and is a little bit further from Boston, and so has a much longer agricultural heritage. So that's sort of, I think, one of the foundations. And then the other thing is that in the last 50 years, really, since the interstate system was constructed,
right,
Vermont became a lot more accessible to the population centers to our south.
Oh, okay.
New York, what have you. You know, so we have this certainly still a really strong rural character. There's only 620,000 people here. The largest city is only 40,000 people.
Wow.
And there are for all kinds. I think that there are a lot of reasons why we won't see Vermont become the next Connecticut. You know, nothing bad about Connecticut. It's just that Connecticut has a much higher population. It has a different character, even though maybe 100 years ago they were sort of similar.
Okay.
You know, I think we're removed enough from the population centers, but not quite so much. So, I mean, these are interesting things to me to think about. And so therefore, we have a history with cheese making, and bread making, of course, and other, I guess we'll call them craft foods, that have been, you know, that people, mostly people who moved here, within the last couple of generations, have taken to, you know, and they've found that Vermont is a good place to, you know, in many cases, these are, food, this food making is tied very closely to the landscape. With bread, it's becoming more so, but it wasn't necessarily tied to the Vermont landscape when we go back 20 or 30 years. But sure. We do have a great. I'm really proud of the fact that we have such a concentration of great bakeries in this state. It's really neat.
Yeah, well, for sure, and that's something I didn't know. It was sort of the how the land is more accepting to agriculture. My whole knowledge of New England is from like old house episodes out of Boston, and they're always talking about bedrock and stuff, and I just assumed it extended a lot further than it does.
But you know, the other thing about the agriculture is that, with the exception of a band of land on the western border and a little bit on the eastern border of the state, that it's not conducive to real large scale agriculture.
Right.
We do have some fairly large dairies, but even those are, they are pretty small in comparison to what you might see in Wisconsin or California.
Gotcha.
So,
sure.
You know, we are, our farming is mostly on a pretty small scale.
Yeah. That's something I'm excited to see one day, because it sounds an awful lot like how, you know, say my grandparents would have got started out here in Saskatchewan, you know, with their you know, the quarter section you got when you settled, kind of a thing. Whereas now there's been so much consolidation. I hear about guys farming 20 sections of land and stuff, and it's just insane to me. You know, compared to when
that can happen in a place like that, because the land is there.
Yeah, exactly. Oh yeah, yeah. We were talking about that yesterday, even with how our city, which is quite small, seems to be expanding at a rapid pace, even though the population isn't going up, because we don't have any natural barriers to growth other than how far do you want to run the water lines, right? So,
yeah,
you know, it's crazy. So are you a native to Vermont? Is that where you're from?
I'm not. I was actually born in California, and then I grew up when I was three, my family moved to Maine, Mid-Coast Maine, and I grew up there. I did go to college in southern Vermont. And my wife is from, she moved when she was very young, 6 months or so, from Rhode Island to Vermont. She grew up quite close to where we are now.
Okay, cool. And so that's sort of how you got back, or you got to Vermont, eh? Was sort of because that's where your wife is from?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, even though it was 2 hours south of here where I went to school, I loved being in Vermont for those years. And but then the connection with Liza's family that we ended up back here.
Gotcha. And do you have like a history of baking in your family, or how did you get into the business?
Not really, although yeah. I'm looking here on the wall of a picture that was taken in 1971 of my mother and I baking bread in California when we were still in Berkeley.
Oh, cool.
My mother did bake bread every day or every week when I was growing up. So I was around it in that way, but it wasn't a commercial operation by
sure.
any means.
And so what gave you the bug to get into this?
Yeah, well, I do always start with that, you know, that my mother had always baked bread at home. And then when I was at school in Southern Vermont, that Marlborough College is where I went. And at the time, there were about 300 students there. It's a real small school. And
wow.
We had a real chef actually running what didn't even really feel like a food service there. And I had worked in various food jobs through high school in the summers. And it was natural to me to get a work study job in the kitchen. And that ended up being a regular job eventually for me. It wasn't even just through the school. I worked really for the food service. And that chef was really encouraging of a few of us who were in the kitchen at the time who were interested in getting more into bread baking. And so when I graduated from Marlborough in 93 with a theater degree, you know, liberal arts, just whatever, I don't regret a moment of it, but it was, you know, I think partly one of these things that could happen 25 years ago more easily than it can today, where you
sure.
go and pursue something that doesn't necessarily have particular career goals. And then I had been baking bread I in the kitchen there, I wanted to pursue that further. So I went out to Seattle and following a girlfriend, but also because I wanted to see about getting a job in a bakery there. And so I did that.
Okay. And where?
Right ever since it professionally.
Yeah. And where did you go in Seattle?
A place called Little Bread Company, which isn't around anymore.
Okay.
It was started in the 70s as a workers collective. And by the time I got there in the summer of 93, one of the collective had kind of fallen apart, and one of the former members of the collective had taken it over, and she was a great person to work for. But there was also exciting things going on in general in Seattle. I was there the year that Macrina opened, and there was a great bakery called Ballard Baking Company, which had a sister bakery called Greenwood Baking Company, and I lived close to there, and I would kind of help out there.
That
was actually where I first pulled a loaf out of a hearth oven, memorable experience. And so it was a fun place to be at that time.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. That one of the things that I'm learning a little bit more as I talk to more people is that people that are heavy into baking now, an awful lot of them have their genesis in a couple different places. And you mentioned a couple already, like Berkeley and that sort of Bay Area, and Seattle is a place that seems that an awful lot of people, no matter where they are in the States, at least, you know, seem to have passed through that area at some point, right? Like, or got their start out there. So that's really cool.
Yeah, it's true. And I do have family still in the Bay Area of, in Berkeley. And so, you know, I would go back and visit Acme and Freddy's and others. So, yes, those were certainly an influence as well, but I want to, make sure that we don't, leave the Vermont bakers out of that, because, you know, since I had gone to school in Southern Vermont at the co-op there, we would get, bread from O Bread, which is still going strong, started in 1977. Baldwin Hill was still in business there in Massachusetts, but their bread would make it up to the co-op there. And Jeffrey Hamelman had his bakery in Brattleboro, which was
the closest. Oh, okay.
that was the closest town to where I went, where Marlboro was. And that was, you know, a real great example of a bakery as a, you know, a real community center. And
oh, awesome.
So that was inspiring as well.
Cool. Cool. Yeah, no, that's great. So there was the heritage in New England was kind of there already to inspire you.
Yeah.
Great. So then I was flipping around your website and stuff, and you've Red Hen started in 99 from what I can see.
That's right.
So how did you get that going? How did it get started for you?
Well, Liza and I had wanted to move back east. Funny that we're both from the east, from the Northeast here, but we met out in Portland, Oregon, and I was working for Grand Central there. And
right.
She had been there longer than I had, and was kind of ready to come back east. And I was there for 3 years, and ended up, you know, writing a business plan there. We kind of formulated our plan to come back east, and we had been back here visiting enough that even though I was really very happy working for Grand Central, but we wanted to move here to Vermont, and we had been visiting, and I knew that there wasn't anything that was right in the area that we wanted to live that was quite like what I wanted to do, and so decided, well, okay, it's time to open up our own place. I'm not the type of person who was a business owner first. I consider myself a baker first and a business owner second.
But, gotcha.
So we came back here. I bought an oven from Grand Central that they were it was lightly used and they were getting rid of it, and I loaded it into a rental truck and towed my car behind it, and
oh man,
middle of January in 99 I drove out here, and Liza was looking for a place where we could stow the thing. As I was driving across the country, I would call and get updates on where we were going to put this thing once we got it here so that I could return the rental truck.
And, oh my gosh.
And I had the business plan, but we didn't have financing. We didn't have a location. So I did all that stuff once I got here and made ends meet for a few months, making maple syrup and helping a farmer out with hay in the fields, and all the while putting the pieces together with a location and the financing.
Oh my god, that's awesome! Like, you'd sort of get the oven, then I guess I got to use it. Let's get going.
And you know, my former employers at Grand Central were nice enough and trusting enough to let me get that with a balloon loan.
Oh, nice!
I didn't have $12,000, and so I had 6 months to figure out how I was going to pay for that. It's kind of crazy. It's one of these things where, you know, I was 29. Like,
yeah,
I just dove right in. I can't imagine myself doing that today.
Yeah. Oh no, I hear you. When we opened our place, I just remember, like, I did it a little bit opposite, because I signed the lease, and then I kind of knew what oven I wanted, but signed the lease first, and then phoned MeWe to try and get an oven, and just assumed that they had a bunch, right? Like,
yeah,
you're an oven manufacturer. I phoned MeWe Canada. You got to have ovens, right? And they said, well, we have one, and it's the one from, you know, IBIE that we used as a demo, and it's in New Jersey. So you can have that, or we'll build you one in Germany, and it'll take like 3 or 4 months.
Yeah.
And like, I got to pay rent, and, you know, my first rent payment's due pretty quick here. It's like, I'll take the one in New Jersey. Tell me again what it is, you know, that kind of thing. And so it's so funny that you have all of these moving parts that have to be in place, but sooner or later you just got to jump with one of them. And with me, it was like finally signing that lease. And then now it's just, okay, the rest has to happen, because I've made that first step, and it's like, somehow we'll make it work. So that's so cool. With the ordeal I had getting that oven from New Jersey into my space, I'm starting to envy you. At least you knew how it got on the truck and how you could maybe get it off the truck. So good for you.
That was helpful. I mean, I was involved in disassembling it so that I could be involved in reassembling it and know something. Yeah.
Mine, the truck driver drove up and said, "How are you getting it off the truck?" I said, oh God. So there's all those startup stories. So how did you, my understanding is that Red Hen started wholesale and is still sort of predominantly or quite a bit wholesale, even though you've got a cafe now. Is that right? Did you start as a wholesale bakery?
Yeah, I saw that as the, for one thing, my interest at the time and still today is mostly in bread.
Right.
And so I wanted to specialize in that. I saw that as also the best way to open our bakery on a shoestring.
Right.
I didn't want to skimp on the oven. And it basically, the things that cost the most significant amount of money were an oven, a walk-in cooler, a mixer.
Yep.
From there it was a bunch of small tools. So we could open a wholesale bread bakery with those things.
Yeah.
And it didn't have to look pretty. just had to pass the health department's standards. And so that's how we did it for 8 years. People could walk in the front door and buy a loaf of bread, but that was about all it
right.
was.
And so when you first started, did you have a crew or was it just you going for the first while?
Day one, we had a driver.
Wow.
And then I was, from day one, my business plan was written to be a 7-day-a-week operation from the get-go.
Right.
Having fresh bread every day was, the type of bread I wanted to be making. I feel like it needs to be presented fresh. And if I was going to do that, that means that we were going to bake every day. So, yeah. And I was really largely modeling it after the bakeries that I'd worked for in Portland and Seattle. And,
right.
We've had to, modify the plan over the years to sort of, conform to conform to the landscape that we have here in Vermont, which is, not conducive to running a whole bunch of trucks around to a lot of different stores. Stores and restaurants. You have to figure out, where are you? Where is it actually going to be worthwhile to make a trip down the road?
Right.
But nonetheless, we were 7-day-a-week operation right from the start, and it took some time for that to really catch on. And so, I was the only baker for a month, and mm-hmm. then I hired another baker at some point, maybe after 3 months, actually took a day off, and it wasn't too long before I hired another one or two bakers. I think by the time we had been in business for 6 months, I probably had 3 bakers.
Gotcha. So because that was one of the things that I was curious about is that 7-day-a-week operation. It's not that's not something I've really got any experience with at all. I did 5, I know some places that do, or a lot of places do 6, but good, so good on you. Was the culture in Vermont sort of receptive to that? Like when you, or did it fit their expectations?
It exceeded their expectations.
Awesome.
Nowadays, I think people mostly understand that that's what we do.
Right.
But that's not what most other bakeries here do. So it's given us an advantage.
Gotcha.
From the beginning. And there were certainly times in the first few years where, it's can sometimes be hard to find drivers, and especially when you're a new business. It's just hard to attract people that come work for you. And, the hours for delivery drivers are tough. So certainly there were times where it's like, oh my God, what have we done? But I think really a lot of, it's a key part of why we are what we are today, that we've always been a 7 day a week operation.
Right.
I don't really regret it. And the other side of it that I hadn't really even considered at the beginning is that it is the best way to maximize your investment. You know, you
sure.
You got everything else, you know, use it as much as you can.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I remember, the one other guy when I was talking with Jim Williams in Rhode Island, I was out at his place and he just said it just became easier to figure out your production when you just were always doing it, you know?
Well, that's true, especially with natural starters, you know,
it's, yeah. Yeah.
You're going to have to babysit that thing one way or the other. So it's as you know, easier yeah. to make it than pour it down the drain or whatever.
That's right. You know, once it's happy, you're a slave to keeping it happy in a way. So you may as well use it up,
yeah.
you know? Yeah, for sure. Well, no, that's cool. And I guess, and I'm assuming with, you know, this emphasis on fresh, then you were saying the drivers have a tough go. It's because they're driving at night an awful lot of the time, right?
Well, they come in at 4:30.
Okay.
Always have, yeah. so that we can try to get to the store. I mean, it's not terribly brutal, but
yeah.
You know, it depends on what's going on. Like right now, unemployment in this state is very low. I think it is nationwide. And
yeah.
If you're somebody who doesn't like getting up that early,
yeah.
These days you can go out and find another job
yep.
pretty easily.
Yeah. Yeah. Whenever there's an oil boom here, which isn't often, but when it does hit, it's like, all of those jobs kind of go away and everyone that would normally be a driver would be moving up north, to work the rigs. Yeah. Crazy. So, yeah. And so, I guess my next thought about wholesale, and I'm really curious about this is, so my assumption always was, because when I opened up, I opened up as a retail bakery, and that if I was doing wholesale now, my focus has to be so much on productivity, whether it's, you know, pounds per hour of dough processed or what have you, right? Because your margins are so low when you're doing wholesale was my assumption. Is that the reality? Is that really a lot of your focus is how do I get the most productivity out of my crew and my system?
I guess so. And you know, I have to say, I guess, you know, I don't, think about that side of it too much, probably because it's how I came to this work to begin with. That first bakery I worked at in Seattle was a wholesale bakery.
Mm-hmm.
The Grand Central, and another bakery that I worked at for a little while I was in Maine after Seattle, was also a wholesale bakery, exclusively at the time I was there. And, I kind of like grew up in this work in working in places that had that model. And
gotcha.
So I was, accustomed to the kind of numbers meaning, you know, labor percentages and ingredient percentages that you had to pay attention to.
Yep.
Cost percentages. And, in order to make it work. And it has always seemed, you know, nothing's easy in this business, but it's always seemed like as long as you've kept track of that, it could work. And I would say that, well, having done both now,
mm-hmm.
And the cafe, the retail side of it second, it has still always been much easier, at least in terms of the startup phase. It was way easier for us to start the wholesale. I mean, that was a new business, so it's always a big struggle at that point. But if you look purely at the books,
yeah.
we reached profitability a lot sooner as a wholesale business than we did as a retail business. And we're in a rural area, so. And we knew that when we opened our retail location, we were giving ourselves a challenge in not being really in a town to speak
right.
of.
Right.
So it's come around, and it took years though to build that. Whereas with the wholesale, we have always been situated in a place where we're it's pretty easy to access a bunch of retail and restaurant accounts. So that has never really been intimidating or daunting to me. And the other factor is that we have a very unique retail landscape here in Vermont. I mean, this gets back to one of the things that makes Vermont special, in my opinion, is that we have a whole bunch of like 10 to 12 stores in our area that consider it a point of pride to have locally produced food.
Oh, there you go. Sure.
And they're high volume stores. They're mostly co-ops. Some of them are just independently owned. None of them are chains. And so they're nice to deal with. They pay on time. They don't give you a hard time about stuff. They love it that we deliver 7 days a week.
Sure.
And so they give us good placement for that because of that. So, you know, the degree to which those stores carried us, I never would have imagined that. It was certainly, I mean, if I went back and looked at my original business plan, it was, I know I was way underestimating what they would do.
Cool. Oh no, that's really neat because that's helpful to me, Randy, because it's an area, like I said, that I don't have any experience in at all. And I keep, and so when you don't have any experience, you make your own stories up. And so, and that's, even when I had my bakery, the thought of, like, I did a couple very small organic markets or like organic stores where I would take, you know, a dozen loaves a week kind of a thing. And that seemed to be the absolute limit of what was possible. So it's nice to hear your story. It's sort of like, oh no, but if you're used to it, you can go in this direction, and it might work that way, you know. But
it depends on the landscape.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
my image of Saskatchewan, where I haven't been to your part of the world either. So right. My image is that. Your town ends, and then the prairie goes on for a long way.
Yep.
Yep. So, you know, you probably did the right thing. There probably is a lot of a potential in terms of wholesale.
Yeah. Yeah. It's more the restaurant thing. And my restaurant experience, I guess, was pretty poor in terms of delivering to there. It was all custom all the time. And so I could never seem to make that work. And again, you know, I'm pretty good at making a decision based on very poor data. So it's like one bad experience is about all it takes to say the whole thing doesn't work. So it's cool to hear, well, here's a situation and a location that could make it work.
So, yeah. Well, yeah. And once again, I emphasize the stores, and they are the ones, and we have a couple of key restaurant accounts now, but not very many. We have a lot of small restaurants that we deliver to,
and, right.
And you're right about the restaurant thing. Often they want something custom. They are the ones who will try to, you know, because they're running a business like our business, you know, they really try to get the price down. My experience with stores is that, you know, as long as you can charge what you need to charge to make it work, and your average customer, you know, who's shopping, putting things into their grocery cart, really doesn't see the huge difference between, you know, 75 cents or a dollar, you know.
Yeah, for sure. Well, and I remember you, I'm pretty sure it was you posting a picture on the Guild site several years back of one of your displays that you had set up at the store, like with the red hen and the bread rack and that kind of thing. And it looked absolutely gorgeous. Am I right?
Yeah, we did one. We had a local craftsman make display racks. That was really a fortunate thing the way that worked out. And he made gunnels for Mad River Canoes, which was a canoe company that was, it's no longer here, but they were located down the road here. And, and the gunnels are made from ash. And so if they didn't make the grade for canoe quality, you know, to be good enough for making a canoe because of slight blemishes, he had these scraps, and he basically made these really nice bread racks out of these this scrap gunnel material.
Wow.
And yeah, I think that I've always been a big advocate of that, having a display that is eye catching.
Yeah. Oh, and it totally was. Like the bread on the rack was spectacular, but just the whole picture was amazing. Like, really stands out. And so that also, I think, speaks to the relationship you've got with the stores and the types of stores that you've got out there, that, you know, you're able to put things like that in, you know.
Yeah.
which would,
and I'll say that, you know, lately in the last few years, stores have gone much more towards a uniform display. And so we have, unfortunately, fewer of those racks out there, but at this point, we've built our business enough, I guess, that it doesn't usually impact our sales a whole lot to take those out, but they are still in many, many stores.
Right. And so when did you decide to open the cafe, Randy?
Well, we moved our whole operation in 07.
Okay.
We'd been in business for 8 years, and we had built the business. I mean, you know, as with any story, of a growing business, I think that, you know, there's a whole lot of lucky breaks along the way. Mm-hmm. I got a much bigger oven, same brand, Bongard. We had started with a Bongard, got another Bongard that was more than twice as big after 2 years. And also at that time, we were able to expand into an adjacent space to just take up the whole space where we, in our original location. And then after 8 years, we were bursting at the seams and at the point where we could actually, the banks trusted us and get a bank loan and make a big move to a building that was the wholesale part of which, the bakery production part of which, was built to our specifications, even though we were renters. And so we didn't have to take on the whole building ownership thing and deal with permitting and all that. I mean, right. There's probably a big advantage to having that building equity like that, but I didn't want to get into that. I'm not a developer.
Gotcha.
And so that opportunity came along, and the funny thing about it was that we did want to have more of a retail than what we had before, where you just like walk in and there's no seating and you just buy a loaf of bread. But this location actually just came with this pre-existing building that the bakery itself was built onto. And that space is still today about 1800 square feet, and which is much bigger than we thought we needed. And we renovated it and opened it up, but told our landlords, like, look, you know, ultimately, I don't think we can really make use of all this space. I think you should find somebody else to, I don't know, sell used books or something, or whatever it would be, something that would be compatible. And they said, well, just try it out and see. And actually, within a year, we realized, okay, I guess we can fill this up. And so we really have kind of stumbled along with the retail thing. I mean, now we know what we're doing and what works and what doesn't work. But that's how that all came about. We thought that we would be mostly a bread bakery, but with also you could get a cup of coffee and some simple pastries.
Sure.
And now we have a full line of all kinds of different pastries, and we make sandwiches and soups and salads, and we sell wine and beer and other kinds of groceries. And we've realized that in order to succeed in this location that, as I said before, is not in a town,
yeah,
would need to be all kinds of different things and attract people for all kinds of different reasons.
Right. So you're drawing people from a wider area than just the village of Middlesex, then?
Definitely. Yeah. The situation here is that the traffic count going past us is, I can't remember exactly what the numbers are, but it's high. Right. I believe there's something like 20,000 on the interstate, which is very close to us here.
Oh, okay.
Exit is just like a quarter mile away. So to the degree that we can get some of those people to come off the highway, that we have a lot of potential there. And then right by the road that we're actually located on, Route 2, it goes all the way across the country, is pretty busy road too, and it's pretty close to a crossroads between the Mad River Valley, which is where we live, and it's kind of a resort town and a little bit of a destination for people, and then another resort town, Stowe, to the north, and we're not too far from the capital, Montpelier, just about 5 miles to the east, and then we're 30 miles from Burlington. So there's all these different reasons that people who are either doing business or are on their way to and from work or visiting the area come across us.
Wow. That's really cool. It's like there's there you go. There's a lot of ways to get there. So worth checking it out if you're listening to this. No, that's awesome. Really sounds to me like this, how to make the most of an opportunity that you've got, right? You know, it's, you learn the advantages.
Yeah. I think, you know, we could have gone down the road, to Montpelier and opened up a cafe there, but that's a little town and couldn't have a 4,000 square foot bakery attached to a 1500 or 2000 square foot retail there. That doesn't fit in a town.
Right on. Yep.
And I didn't want to separate the two. I wanted the experience to be that people could see things being made.
Yeah.
Cafe and also for us all as people who work here to feel that we're all one operation.
Right on.
Take the baked goods through the door and then and have them for people rather than trucking them down the road. So that because of that, it meant that we needed to figure out how to make the retail side of it work.
Sure.
This location.
Sure. And there is something. I'm a romantic about this, but you know, any place that I can go into where I can see the guys baking, especially on like a large scale, while I'm having my coffee or whatever, is just so cool. Like it's just the neatest thing to say, like, oh, this is actually where it's from, you know.
People really enjoy it. One of the things I really love is that kids look through the window all the time.
Yeah.
And see the things going on, you know. I mean, we live in a time when people aren't necessarily so connected to where their food comes from. So yep. I always want to promote that.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. We had this we had these big windows at our space, and there was a daycare in the little strip mall that our bakery was in, and every morning. This one little girl would be walking with her mom to the daycare, and she would stop and look through the window, and I could always see her from the bench, and you know, would give her a wave and stuff. And then, you know, within a few years, now she's off. She's in grade one, so she comes in and says, "Like, where?" You know, it's like, "I haven't seen you in ages." Well, because I'm in school all day, you know. And it's so cool to see that. It's it's the best. It's the absolute best. You know, nothing made my chest puff out and be proud about whatever I was shaping at the time is when these little kids would come walking by and just peer in like this was magic. So so cool. So Randy, I read an article about you and a couple of years back, and Red Hen to me is also it's meant many things from afar, but also as sort of one of the great examples of a bakery that can make things work and also care for their employees. And I know you've even been recognized as a top employer. And I was wondering if you could talk about that a little bit, about sort of what you've been able to set up and and make work for your employees and how that fits in with your business?
Well, how it fits in with our business, I always feel that it's so critical to our business.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. For sure.
You know, this is labor intensive work. I mean, if you look at our, any bakeries, any bakery of this type, at least, gross sales to number of employees, you know, it's pretty, there aren't a lot of other businesses that have so many employees for such a low gross sales number.
Exactly.
Because we're making things, you know, and we're making things by hand. And if I don't have skilled hands doing those things, then it doesn't work. And so, you know, there it is in line with our values to be doing right by people as much as we can. But for sure. Of course, there is a practical side of it that, you know, if we can't keep people, if we can't attract good people, we don't have a business. You know, we don't have the kind of business we want.
Right.
So it's there's two things there, and it's always a struggle. It's always a work in progress in terms of how to continually do the best we can there. You know, as we've grown, one of the things that and this is something we've dealt with more this summer, I think, because for a lot of the summer we've been a little bit short staffed because it's been hard to find people.
Right,
with the employment rate as low as it is. And the potential is there for this to be exhausting work.
Yes.
And, you know, so this is one of the things I've been thinking about a lot lately is it's one thing to pay people well. It's one thing to, have a good benefits package. It's another thing to, continually on a daily basis, make this, a fulfilling place to be and not one that just feels like, you're a slave to, you know, pumping out stuff.
Right.
And, you know, we do a lot of different things, to that end. We have to stay vigilant about that. You know, it's easy to kind of get into a mode where it's like, you know, you talked about efficiency at the beginning and, to focus only on that, you know, because the most efficient way to do things might be to have one person doing one job all day long.
Right.
Ultimately, in the long run, that's not the best way to do things. It's ultimately going to impact efficiency because that person's going to leave.
Yeah. It's a very brittle. It's a very brittle system.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So. You know, I want to train complete bakers, you know, who really understand things. And you know, I tell people in job interviews right off the bat that doesn't happen. That's not going to happen in a few months. It's going to be the better part of a year or more before you really understand everything that goes on here. And the degree to which anybody gets to that point depends on their skill level, their motivation, and to a degree, our needs. So, you know, the pay and benefits thing is almost kind of the easy part.
Okay.
I mean, that's a numbers thing.
Yes.
In my opinion, it's really important to prioritize that. And basically I try to run this in a way that, has a slim, I mean, not that that's a struggle in a bakery business to have a slim profit margin, but you know, anything we can do on the payroll and benefits side, that we feel that we can afford to do while not sacrificing our, well-being as a business, we do, you know, that's a priority.
Sure. Sure. You know, when I asked the question, it's funny, I was thinking specifically about, healthcare and benefits and maternity leave and those types of things. And then you mentioned something about, you know, even with all of that, it's got to be a compelling place to come to every day. And you can't have this feeling of just that repetitive very physical drudgery, you know, to go. Yeah. And so, are you doing anything, or what are you doing specifically, or what are your thoughts, I guess, around that as to how to make it a good day at the shop?
Sure. So one thing is that we have I want to connect people, the bakers, to what they're doing.
Yeah.
We have three shifts, mixing, shaping, and baking. And right. And some of them overlap, mm-hmm. and some people overlap with those, but nobody's making the bread from start to finish on one single day.
Right.
So one of our challenges is to connect people to what it is they're making. And we set aside a loaf from each bake, one of each of the varieties that we're making. And we take a few minutes in the afternoon every day, and we look at how the bake was the day before and discuss things. And we also have a sheet that goes along with that, that follows the bread all the way through, so that people are, they have to take a moment and evaluate how the dough is at all the different stages, how it feels on the bench, how it was in the proofing, how it was throughout the baking. This brings all the people who are involved in the different parts of the process together in thinking about this. And then of course connecting it to actually tasting the bread, evaluating
sure.
it.
Sure.
That's one really important piece of it for me. And then, you know, there are other things, like we have a massage therapist who comes in every month. And, you know, this is just about everybody here is doing really physical work. And this guy comes in 2 days a month. And for anybody who signs up for it, they get a 20-minute massage, and he can focus on the parts of their body that might be bothering them more. And, you know, just partly to acknowledge, like, look, we know that this is taxing work. And hopefully, you know, it does have a physical effect, but I think it also has a mental impact on people to know that, you know, this isn't just about being a machine.
Exactly. Yeah, for sure. For sure. Well, and that's it's so true, right? It's like, you know, the fact that you've got people doing all the steps in the process as opposed to an automated line means you've got also got folks that can do that evaluation. So it's so neat to that's an interesting system that you've got to help them do that evaluation through the whole process. That's really cool. We used to do that on a much smaller scale at our shop. You know, pull a couple loaves off the racks and let's take a look at these every once in a while. And it was always a lot of fun, and I think fairly interesting for the staff as well. Right? I think when you're in the thick of it, sometimes it's just to get it done in the time that you've got, and so it's nice to take a deep breath and take a look at what you've made.
Yeah, that's right. And then, you know, other things that are along similar lines are, of course, we're a member of the Bread Bakers Guild.
Sure.
And based on our sales level, that means that we have 7 memberships. So I've got, 7 bakers who've been with us for a while who get bread lines and participate in the email list. Look at it and, you know, remember that there is a larger world out there.
Yes.
Of bakers. We've also done something a few times. You mentioned Jim Williams earlier. He's one of the bakeries we've done this with, a little baker's exchange.
Oh, cool.
And this is actually something I'd love to do more of. Jeffrey Hamelman had an idea of doing this, and he and I tried to work on it and get some others interested, but it didn't. This was a couple of years back. It didn't really get off the ground, but I still have hopes that we could make it a more slightly formalized, but not too formalized thing where bakers could just come and work in another bakery for a week or so. And so we've done that with Jim. He's sent people here, and we've sent people down there. And Standard Baking Company in Portland, Maine, is another one that at least, I guess they haven't sent anybody here, but we've sent one of our guys there, and they've been really welcoming of that. And, you know, I think that we've also sent bakers to events like the Kneading Conference, yes, and yep. also Doc, and the Grain Gathering. And I think that when I go to events like that, the classes are often really good, but what I get the most out of is talking to other bakers about what they do on a day-to-day basis. And that's inspiring and exciting. And I want to make sure that some of our employees are getting that experience as well.
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, that's a nice callback to even like this podcast is one of my hopes is that we, you know, people when they're working around the bench can realize that, hey, they're part of something bigger, than, you know, especially on those dark days where it does get really hard, you know, let's say, hey, you're a part of something bigger. There's a lot of this going on and there's a lot of people just like you and, you know, together we can make it better. Right. So that's awesome. That exchange idea is really neat. I remember there was a day that we were struggling a lot with our croissants and I was really close to just pulling the trigger and sending my pastry person up to see Tracy in Saskatoon and say, can you just spend a couple of days with Tracy and get it grooved that way? You know, because when you're in your own head, sometimes trying to fix things, all it takes is someone else to look at someone else or to have them look at what you do and it's an easy fix.
Yeah, absolutely.
So cool. No, that's great, Randy. And that's it also speaks to the special kind of place where you are that there are that many really great bakeries close enough that you can pull something like that off, you know, that you probably wouldn't have to get on a plane to do it.
That's true. I mean, some of the things that I just described do involve getting on the plane.
Sure, of course.
And, you know, we're only 60 miles from the King Arthur Baking Center, and I've sent a number of bakers down there for classes.
Nice. That's a place that I'd love to learn more about. Where is King Arthur again?
In Norwich, Vermont, which is right on the Connecticut River.
Okay, so it's south of you.
It's a little more east than south. It's southeast.
Okay, gotcha. Okay. Yeah, I'm just I've been studying maps of the area. Sort of, if I was doing my dream trip, how would I connect all those dots? So
yeah, well, you know, the good thing as opposed to part of the world you come from, in New England, nothing's too far away from anything
yeah.
else. You know, when you said you were at Seven Stars, I thought, well, you should have just popped up here. It's only
Yeah, I know. Isn't that crazy? For me, like the closest for me is to drive up to Saskatoon, which is about 2.5 hours away. But after that, so I can go visit Tracy and there's another fellow up there I can go visit or we're talking 6 hours to Winnipeg or 8 hours to Calgary or Edmonton. It's just insane. You know, and it's just like prairie in between. So
I think I could be in Providence in 4 hours.
And, wow.
But there's going through three states.
Yeah, for sure. That's so neat. Hey, and so I guess one last question, Randy, is again, reading on your website that you're fairly recently getting into a little bit of fresh milling as well, hey?
Yep.
How's that going for you? Before I let you answer, I just need to say when I read the article on your website about you getting your mill from Jansen Grist Mills.
Yeah.
That I just found out about those folks via Instagram like 3 weeks ago and I've been like, oh, this is cool. And then, but I've never heard of you before. And then I was reading the article last night and I was like, oh, you know, these guys and they've got an interesting story too. But so how's the fresh milling experience?
It's been really, remarkably good. You know, as I said, I believe in that blog post that came about because this local farmer started growing rye.
Right.
Work with a couple of other local farmers who supply us with wheat flour. And, you know, the flour, because part of their business is based on them being able to add the value there at the farm.
Right.
So Really, the best way for us to support those farmers over the years has been to buy flour rather than grain.
Right.
I've kind of been left out of the milling thing, which is, maybe it makes me a little envious of those who built their businesses around fresh milling. But I did. I wanted it to, you know, come naturally if it did for us. If it came ever. And so when this rye that appeared to be quite good, I have to thank James McGuire from Montreal, who has done a lot of rye research in recent years. And he milled and baked with a sample of this rye from that was grown in Vermont and really was very excited about it. And even included it in an article that he'd written for The Art of Eating. And I thought, okay, so this is an opportunity. Let's dip our toes into this. You know, many people know Andrew Hine from Elmore Mountain Bakery and now New American Stone Mills.
Right.
Just up the road from us, another great Vermont bakery, but now a widely recognized, world-renowned mill designer and builder. And, you know, his mills are really, it appears to me to be the bee's knees when it comes to stone mills these days. But we weren't quite ready to jump into something, an investment of that scale.
Sure. So
Hanson Mill seemed like a good option for seeing if this was all going to work for us. And so it's actually been as simple as taking this rye and milling it up and using it for currently we're waiting for the next harvest to come in. We ran through everything that he had from the 2017 harvest. So it's been about 6 weeks since we've been able to mill any of his rye, but it'll start again soon here, assuming that the quality is good again.
Yeah.
Of course, that's how it is when you're dealing with local farmers. But it worked really well. For about 6 months, all of the rye that we used came exclusively from this farmer, and that includes what we use in a couple of breads that have no wheat. They're rye-based breads.
Wow.
I never really expected that would work out. And it could have been beginner's luck in terms of just having a good crop from last year. But I mean, I don't want to make it sound like milling is just simple, but if you have a good mill and you can mill it the way you want to,
right,
in terms of like granulation, it's really about the quality of the grain.
Yeah.
And so we were fortunate in having good quality grain. And I think it improved all of the breads that we were using rye in. I mean, you know, even in the Campania style bread that we make that is only about 9 or 10% rye. We all thought, oh, look at this! It adds a nice new character to it. I mean, it's certainly something I would consider fairly subtle.
Right.
You know, probably we all notice at the bakery more than customers notice it, but. People do also always appreciate a good story.
Sure.
So, and that's meaningful.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. Well, that's great. The whole local grain, fresh milling thing is something that I've been learning more about and been fascinated by over the last couple of years. And so it's nice to hear another story of where it's kind of working out and that you're able to connect up with a new farmer as well as like, and I know you've had their relationship with the folks in Quebec for a long time.
But it's Vermont. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's awesome. Well, hey, well, thanks. Thanks so much. Is anything that I've learned a ton. Is there anything that you wish that I had asked you or that we forgot to cover? Cause
geez, I don't know. I mean, I actually think you did a great job.
Awesome, man. Well, thank you. Awesome. Well, that's great. I just want to end the chat here, if I could, just by just by thanking you, Randy, I guess from the guild and the e-group perspective, because from the entire time that I was thinking about opening up my own place and dreaming about my own place and to actually opening it and running it, you were one of the folks that I always admired through the email group at the guild, and just quite honestly, when any time you posted anything, that was one I was going to read. And there was like a handful of folks through those email lists that I really think that you were a part of my bakery way more than you know, just because of your advice and your perspective and the positive attitude that kept coming through on all of your posts and the realism, of like, hey, some of these are real struggles that we're all going through, and let's try and figure out how to make it better. So I really appreciate that. And you've been a great mentor from afar for me. So thank you for that. And I really appreciate you coming on the call today too.
That's great to hear. I'm really, that's really nice to hear that somebody on the other end of those emails was, receiving those things in that way.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely. It's true. And, I know I'm not alone, but I will speak for myself. So thanks so much.
You must have disagreed with me somewhere along the line.
Oh, I'm sure, always in the, well, he's a good guy, but I'm not going to take this advice. But that doesn't make him wrong. That makes me stubborn. So, it's funny how the mind works. You can always bend pretty much anything to make the answer that you wanted to hear anyhow. So, cool. Well, thanks a bunch. And
thank you, Mark.
Thanks for listening to this Second Rise chat. If you enjoyed this talk, there are over 170 more conversations with bakers from all around the world at riseuppod.com. Head on over and give them a listen. And if you love the show, click on that gorgeous little support the show button too. Every contribution is welcome, helpful, and treasured. And if there's a baker that you think I should be talking to, drop me a line at Mark with a K at riseuppod.com and let me know. I'd love to hear from you. Until next week, keep making the good stuff. Work hard, bake lots, rest when you need it. Happy baking. Bye-bye.